My name is Kathy Blunker, and I think it's important in a time when we have lots of decisions to make as individuals and communities of different sizes, local and global, to think about how we go about making decisions of any kind. Ethics is thinking about decision making, thinking about behavior. Morality is behavior. Ethics is thinking about behavior. I'm sure you've all had the experience of trying to get into a conversation with someone to discuss some difference of opinion, and they just seem to be off the wall. You know how right you are, but they're just nuts. And the reason they finally come down to that they've made this decision is something like, well, just because I know it, or because I think so, or because God told me, or some emotional response that really doesn't lead to any kind of conversation. Especially as Dick said, if God told me something different. So we construct systems of ethics, and I'm not a philosopher and I don't have training in philosophy, but I've done some reading about environmental ethics and also about some very classical ways of what's called doing ethics in all of the scope of our life. So I'm going to introduce these. And I think I'll do it there are two basic frameworks, and I'll do it one at a time and see if we have time for discussion. So this framework that I'm going to talk about now is to do with environmental ethics. The second framework is to do with ethics in general. And as we go through these and discuss them, think about where you tend to fit in. You'll tend to fit in somewhere. Something will kind of feel right. And it may be that you are a mixture of two of them or three, but just kind of think about where you are comfortable. The first one is anthropocentric, which simply means human-centered. And bear in mind that these are just different ways of doing ethics. None are better or worse than others. Anthropocentric means that the decisions that you make are based on what you feel is good and right and appropriate for the human species. A lot of national park brochures, for one small example, you'll read, and it'll say things like stay on the trails, don't litter, put your fires in fire rings, and so forth, so that we may keep this area beautiful for our grandchildren. That's the clue, for our grandchildren. Okay, we're keeping it beautiful, which is a good thing, I think. And the reason we're doing it is because we have these generations down the road that we're thinking about. There's an Iroquois saying that says something about when we make decisions, thinking about seven generations to come. Okay, these are human-centered ethics. The next one is biocentric. Which is life-centered. And a biocentrist would argue that more than just the human species has inherent worth or inherent value. That all living things have equal value and deserve equal consideration. To a biocentrist, environmental ethics is not a subset of human ethics. Okay? If we are keeping our forests clean for the sake of our grandchildren or pristine, then that means that environmental ethics is a subset of human ethics. We're doing this for what we conceive to be our responsibility to each other as people. A biocentrist would say, no, that's not broad enough. You can't just, you know, people aren't the most important thing on this planet. In fact, look what they've done. But the animals and the plants, the population, the rainforest has a right of its own to exist, not just because of its perceived usefulness or beauty to humanity, but all on its own. It has its own right to exist. A possible scenario between these two groups might be the building a dam to provide hydroelectric power to an area which has no power. One result of building this dam might be the extinction of the species of snail or fish or something. You've heard stories like this. What might an anthropocentric person say in this argument over whether or not to build a dam?
It's okay.
Sure.
There are going to be more people helped and saved and living better that, you don't care, that it's worth more than, that's worth more than the snail or the
slug. Okay. So quality of living has bearing to an anthropocentrist, plus being able to live at all. Okay, what might a biocentrist say then in this issue?
And
that the slug has as much value and right to be on the earth as we have the right to be the same, or equal with us.
Okay. Yes, those are both valid arguments that each of the groups would use. The problems come when the people who, for instance, are anthropocentric cannot understand this slug business. It's just a slug, for goodness sakes. Look at all these people who don't have water. We could irrigate the land. We could do a lot of things if we had this water. And what's all this foolishness over this slug? Meanwhile, the biocentrist is saying, you arrogant fools, don't you know that you can't just disturb one thing, and extinction of any species is not appropriate, and so forth. But at least if they can talk about where they're coming from, then there's a possibility of rational discussion. There's not always a possibility of coming together, but there is a possibility of discussion.
We have that now in Castle Rock, in our area, the logging area, because against the owl,
yeah.
You know, so we have a big, big issue, and it's going to turn out into all-out war, as far as I can tell.
Okay, I want to write the name as we kind of talk about some of these issues, because I want to talk about them is when I get this third one up here.
Can you talk a little bit about the construction of the Grand Coulee Dam that opened up this whole Northwest to profitable agriculture and growing? What did it do in a negative sense?
Probably plenty, really. We can't know about that. Mm-hmm. We haven't thought about it.
I just because we saw it on the way out, mm-hmm. it comes to my mind.
Yeah.
And the area apparently was impoverished before the land was. So is that justified?
Well, and I'm from the Midwest, and I don't know the history of just what happened with the Grand Coulee Dam, but these are the kinds of arguments
did a tremendous amount of good.
Of course.
But not knowing, I imagine, that it killed a few snails or something.
Well, they say that it opened up the whole area.
It did.
The apple industry, the fruit industry, yeah. And everything here. So that had to be good, didn't it?
A biocentrist might say, well, sure, it was good for people.
Right. Yeah.
However, you always drown rivers, you always drown land when you build a dam. Mm-hmm. And you don't know just what's happening when you're drowning that land. Harold.
One of the things about the Grand Coulee, though, is what the water that it's supplied to, that's semi-arid out there, folks. You take that water down and they'll be stopping the traffic for a wind to blow the dust across.
Oh, yeah.
Right now, I mean, it won't take, and all, if you think I'm kidding, all you need to do is go to one of those circular fields and get on the outside. Yeah. The last row of corn is about 3 inches long, when the sixth row in is 6 feet high and two big ears on it. The ears are bigger than the stalk. And there's a guy that explained it to me. He says, well, he said, I'll tell you what, you're on the wrong side. The westerly winds blow, so the water never gets here. Mm-hmm. And the wind does blow out there. But the other side of that is, they explained it to us over there, the population of the whole area from Yakima all the way north was less than 10,000 prior to the Grand Coulee Dam. Yes. They talk about Moses Lake being a store, a post office, and a couple of houses.
Mm-hmm. And my son.
And now, of course, that whole area is a population that the Grand Coulee Dam serves. Has about a population of well over 100,000, but it has stopped the salmon from going up the Columbia River.
See, and this is where the biocentrist would say what you did was wrong, because if you have to irrigate so extensively, it's obvious those crops don't belong there.
Boy, that's a...
And if you have to do all this unnatural stuff to get water into the area, then maybe people don't belong there either in such droves.
Gee.
You know, if you go out to nature, the animals have their own niche, and they don't try and live where there is no water, where there is no habitat. They go away from those areas.
Or they die out.
Or they die out.
Well, they would have died out anyway,
they become
because
extinct.
They couldn't live there.
No,
well,
no, I disagree.
They were living there in the first place. They weren't there, first place, because there was.
You mean animals?
Animals weren't there.
This is, oh sure, there were.
Rattlesnakes.
Oh sure.
Rattlesnakes, yeah.
Well, the desert is a whole community itself, full of animals, full of plants, and they were there. And there's undoubtedly species that are no longer there because the dam was built.
I was thinking the a little more spicy, is the Bonneville Dam on the Columbia River. There are two peoples. Here are Indians who need the salmon, who have fishing holes, who do not want that dam. It's going to destroy their way of life. And here's the white folks saying, I need electricity. And so you've got anthropocentric issues between each other right there. Mm-hmm. And the biocentrics never got a word in.
What about the Rural Electrification Administration back in the 1930s in the Appalachians?
Mm-hmm. Building dams.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Did anyone see Deliverance?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's a very hard movie to watch. It's a very difficult movie to watch. But the whole premise is that they're going to drown the river. A wild, beautiful river. Mm. So it's one last trip down this magnificent river that's going to be exterminated, plus all the biota along it. John Muir, his favorite valley in Yosemite was drowned. Mm-hmm. And once this happens, there is no return. So one of the questions, well, I'll get to this in a minute. What shall I call this? Steps to a decision. One of these steps we'll get to in a few minutes. I forget what number is. Is this decision reversible? Critical question. Okay, so we'll put that on the back burner. The third one I want to get in here is holism. I should make this parallel here. the holists would say, no, biocentrism is not broad enough, because the earth, and to a degree the cosmos, but particularly the planet that we're living on, is like an organism in which everything is an integral part, including the rocks, the winds, the water, the forest fires. All of these things are an integral part of the whole. And if anything is extirpated from this, then the whole organ suffers. Now, an example would be a human body, okay? If you cut your hair, if you cut your fingernails, you're not going to suffer, right? Aldo Leopold is the proponent of this land ethic. Aldo Leopold was an avid hunter and fisher. Okay, he wasn't an animal rights person, for example, said that you, for no reason, take an animal's life because each one has its own inherent value. And by the way, in formal philosophy, inherent value and intrinsic worth are very tight terms. I'm throwing them kind of loosely, but those are tight terms. However, if you cause the extinction of a species, okay, you're pulling out a whole part. You're cutting off an arm. That won't grow back. Okay? So in a situation, for example, in northern Wisconsin, where there are so many white-tailed deer that they're destroying the white cedar woods, it's much better in the eyes of someone who follows the land ethic to hunt the deer, get it down to a sizable population, because it's still big, but it's better to do that than it is to save all the deer, because each individual is valuable. Okay, because once we destroy this biotic organism, the deer can come and go numbers-wise, but that organism is not replaceable.
I think you'll find there's more deer in central Wisconsin now than there are in northern Wisconsin, and there's more deer in southern Wisconsin than they've ever had.
Oh, I know that's true.
And in Ohio, where they never saw deer, Lord help you. But I had a friend of mine who used to fish with me, and he used to ice fish, and at about 7 o'clock at night or 6:30, just before the sun went down, the wolves would come on the lake.
The wolves?
Wolves.
Yeah.
They would walk about 100 yards around us, and they would circle us until we left. We always left them 30 or 40 fish, because we always had more than we needed anyway. And they cleaned them up, because we'd usually go on Sunday and Monday. But one day he was talking to me, he says, you know, he said, if these confounded hunters would just leave the wolves alone, they would keep the deer pack under control.
And they wonder what
you. And I thought, you're kidding. And he really wasn't, because he finally said, he said, the wolf can't do anything with a healthy deer. They can't catch him. A healthy deer will run away. But you get a sick deer or an old deer, which has to be culled, they're great for that. And he said, when the wolf calls, the bones are left. Well, then down the line come the birds and the rest of the animals to live off what's left. But he said, we have to have all these rules and regulations that wolves are bad and bears are bad. Everything is bad only because they disrupt our intrusion into their home.
That's a real good point. And just a real brief synopsis of the wolf thing, because this is a point that people disagree on. There has never been one recorded attack ever of a wolf on a human.
What about Peter and the Wolf?
Well, and Little Red Riding Hood.
And Little Red Riding Hood.
Swallowed that grandma that all up dress. In one swallow.
A wolf isn't that big. It's smaller than the average German police dog.
Well, the problem with the wolves is, now this is looking from the other's perspective, because I think that, and Aldo Leopold talks about his almost conversion from thinking that deer are good. He worked as a wildlife manager, so they shot all the wolves so people could come in and, you know, hunt the deer. However, when you remove the top predator, then you've got this this huge explosion of deer, and they eat out all the vegetation, and then they die of starvation and all kinds of problems like that. And of course, then the vegetation dies. We have about three or four packs of wolves, and a pack is a family living unit in Wisconsin. They're protected by law. We cannot have any more anymore because we have destroyed their habitat. They need large areas of habitat. They will not cross a four-lane road. We have chopped up the Shawamagon Forest. We have chopped up the Northern Highlands Forest to the point where they don't have the space that they need. So with the 12 or 15 wolves in Wisconsin, you know, they eat maybe, how many, you know, maybe one deer a week for the winter. It's not a lot. It's not a lot. A wolf isn't that much bigger than a deer.
I don't think he's as big as a big German Shepherd.
Well,
wolf isn't very big.
It's not a big animal.
Right. So this service that Stuart and Lisa did the other night with the wolf was almost one of reminiscence and regret that people have decided that the wolf is such an evil thing.
Except the possibility exists that the wolf is just like deer. When I was in Wisconsin, we had a camp at Wapaka. 54 is the first year I went. They didn't talk about deer. 56, they saw them. The deer were coming down from Burnham Wood and Wausau across Highway 29. I have a feeling the wolf is going to finally figure out someday I got to cross that road or go under it.
No, they will become extinct first. Coyotes are expanding their territory tremendously.
Why won't the wolf venture?
Because it's an instinct. I mean, that's like saying that that a bird that has forever had a niche in the middle of the canopy.
But you know, there's hardly any four lane roads in northern Wisconsin.
Well, and there are a lot of forest roads that some of them won't cross. It's just the nature of the beast. And this is the whole point, that the nature of the beast says, if my niche is gone, so am I. Just to read you a couple of things from Aldo Leopold's book, A Sand County Almanac, about his, just to sort of summarize the land ethic.
We saw this on PBS.
Mm-hmm. Series not long ago. Okay, all ethics, this is general ethics, all ethics so far evolved rest upon a single premise. This is human ethics as well. That the individual is a member of a community of interdependent parts. Okay, that's the premise. An individual is a member of a community of interdependent parts. The land ethic simply enlarges the boundaries of the community to include soils, waters, plants, and animals, or collectively, the land. In short, a land ethic changes the role of Homo sapiens from conqueror of the land community to plain member and citizen of it. It implies respect for his fellow members and also respect for the community as such.
Is there any hope for changing, maybe a global change about that?
One more little thing, Jamie, just a second. A thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community. It is wrong when it tends otherwise. So the decisions you make, according to Leopold, are right. We'll talk more about right and wrong in a few minutes. When it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community, I would extend that even further to include the non-biotic community. that's my thought. It is wrong when it tends otherwise. Do we think that?
I just wonder if anybody can imagine a shift of consciousness so that we don't totally make that different view before we do our development.
So what you're telling me now is that you tend to fall under this?
Yeah.
I mean, this is what you seem to be comfortable with?
That's what seems to work for me.
Well, this was written in the 40s.
Half a century ago.
It is a half a century.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like it.
He does say something somewhere that I kind of like that, oh, maybe this is it. No. Somewhere he says, it has taken 2,000 years to come to, and I don't know his exact words, a half-baked idea of human ethics. We can't expect to accomplish a land ethic overnight. Okay, so let's add this holistic land ethic in here. Are there any animal rights people here? Do you know what I mean by animal rights? Okay, it's not just the animal testing. It's
I don't know, but I do books for a lady that I help a lot, and she, you know, she's really really into animal rights, and she subscribes. She sends money to all these. To these organizations, mm-hmm. And then you know, oh. But on the other hand, she has cats and she feeds them canned cat food and you know they're killing it. And so, but you can't get that through to her. I mean, she can't understand that there's got to be a balance. I mean, she shouldn't have all those. You know, one cat is fine, but you know she doesn't have anything that the cats are going to get. But anyway, yeah, but. Once people get you on your list for this, it's a terrific amount of mail that she gets. Her box is full every day.
Oh yeah.
From the animal rights groups, yeah. And I mean, it's from being really weird to some really good causes. But you know, she doesn't know how to.
Yeah, I have a cousin in New York. Must have 40 cats in her condo. But I read where that can be a substitution thing. Substituting animals for people. That's
well,
what I read anyway.
It may be that she just likes cats and they
keep
her company.
Well, she does. She picks up all the strays around Manhattan and brings them home.
But
and the place, you know, is a mess. But anyway, I just read a big thing that said people that go to those extremes have problems, real problems. So I don't know.
Well,
I haven't found out what a problem really is. I just read it.
Yeah. A real strong animal rights person will not eat anything that is made from animal, even cheese that is coagulated with rennet, because that's from a calf stomach. Won't wear leather, you know, won't do any of these things because part of the way to get into conversation is to not react by thinking, and we all do, I think, nuts, is to say, well, you know, these are your opinions. Mm-hmm. They differ from mine, but let's talk about them.
Yeah.
But that would be, I don't know how those could be other than a biocentric person. Okay, let's look at this owl for a few minutes. What do you think about that? And where do you stand on that?
Well,
and when you tell us about where you stand on it. We're all friends, I hope. Try and fit yourself into one of these categories as much as possible, or maybe you overlap somewhere. Where do you come from in making your opinions about this controversy?
Well, you get mixed up when you hear on TV that a whole area, a whole little city, they're all going to be out of work, every one of them, going to have no job.
The owl issue is not just the spotted owl.
Right.
The spotted owl is an indicator species. And if that is that it, which is easy to identify in the forest. They can find it and count it and do all the things that it's supposed to do. And if that declines and goes extinct, then they can't measure the other things that are immeasurable at this time. So it isn't like it's just the spotted owl. Spotted owl is an indication that the whole system is either in good health or mediocre health or lousy health or dead.
I understood it was because the spotted owl was almost extinct and they're trying to save
that. That's right. As it goes extinct, the whole ecosystem goes.
Yeah. Owls are top predators, okay? If the owl goes, now think about this in layers, okay? Think about the owls eating voles, for example.
What?
Vole, it's like a little mouse, it's like a little, you know,
rodent.
A little rodent. Yeah. Okay, but again, rodent carries connotations of rats and ugly things. So let's just say a little carnivore or just a little animal. Okay, what happens, little hors d'oeuvre, little snack. And by the way, you can, owls are a kind of bird that regurgitates pellets after it eats. And you can take these pellets apart and reconstruct the meal that the owl has had in the previous 24 hours. So that you can, if you take a pile of pellets under an owl's nest, take them apart, and there are keys that keys to bones in the typical animals, you can find out just exactly how many of what the owl has eaten in the 24 hours. So now let's say that we lose the top predator, which is the owl. Actually, the top predator is us, but in this ecosystem, we'll say the owl. What happens to the population of vole that was their primary diet?
Yeah.
Okay, suddenly all those people there are going to have all kinds of critters in their homes that weren't there before. Okay, the voles are going to eat food, right? What's going to happen if you have suddenly 10 million instead of 1 million voles?
This is just like the deer, isn't it? Mm-hmm. The wolf.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you have 10 million voles instead of 1 million, what's going to happen to their food supply? It's going to crash.
I was just wondering if they'll be able to get these people into another line of work, because that's all they know is logging, and the whole town survives on it. And I, you know, what I'm saying is I also feel sorry for those people that are going to be all out of work, and the whole town fold up. There's several, quite a few like that in Washington State.
Well, Mount St. Helens already did the loggers in. You know, the mountain blew up and it, of course it did the animals and it did everything and it almost did the people in, which it did 60-some
people in.
Yeah. And so we live in that area now where we're living under a volcano. We never know when this thing is going to erupt again.
Mm-hmm.
And when all these lives and all these people, and we're not going to have children or grandchildren or anybody else. And so when you make a spotted owl such a bone of contention that loggers are going to be out of work because of a spotted owl, when they've already gone through this crisis and lived under it for 10 years, where they can't go back in the woods, they can't work because their working area is completely gone. God took it away, or whoever took it away. So I think that this is really a political issue.
Well, I see very clearly where you fit on this. Do you see where, at least, that's at
well,
least where I think
I see, I can see both things. I mean, I think the wilderness
between two.
Wilderness is gone. I wish there was an answer. The holistic area thing seems to be the answer. But how that will ever come about.
Okay.
I know it doesn't. Isn't going to come about in my generation anymore. It probably not. Maybe even my children's generation.
But another issue to bring up to that, in particular, the owl needs old growth timber, and there is something like 10 years left of logging old growth timber. So do we cut it out now, or do we cut it out in 10 years? Someday, there aren't going to be any trees for those loggers. So,
yeah.
It seems like the people have to adjust at some
point.
Then we need to stop using more materials, right?
Well, they're good. The old growth is used for completely different kinds of things, but.
But we're shipping
can
all
you
a lot of
just define old growth for us?
Oh.
How is old growth?
Quite a few years.
How old?
This is all second growth. This is none of this in this.
None of this is old growth.
This is all second growth and it's put 100.
Old growth would be 600, 700, 800 thousand year old trees.
Right.
Trees have been here as before our band settled this area.
Yeah. The 6 foot.
Well, that's foot. Only 200 years. Well, and we're talking still.
How would you work for Simpson?
What? 300 to 600 years for old growth.
Oh, more than that.
Okay.
Yeah, it's, I know. Carol.
By the way, Carol is our ranger. I'm glad to see that she's
400 to 500.
That's just a mile.
400 to 500 years.
Broad, weak, or dripping.
There's all kinds of definitions for old growth. One of them, for one thing, fire has is in the habit of over time wiping out. Even old growth forests or parts of them every now and again. And whatever comes back up there naturally, it came 200 years ago. Isn't that old growth?
Again, I'm from the Midwest and our definitions are real.
That's why I want to go for a couple of minutes. I hear all you groaning and wondering about the poor blockers. Did you have any concern about the steel makers in Pittsburgh when they closed up all the steel mills? Nobody gave a damn. They said, buy Japan. They did.
Yeah, I was thinking that. I was thinking
because
telephone operators.
Another example is Northern Wisconsin.
We're all going down the tube anyway.
Another example of this is Northern Wisconsin with the railroads when they started cutting back. I was in a town when the sign went up one day. You're out of work. Good luck for you. 500 men.
Yeah.
No training in except fixing steam engines. Well, there are no more steam engines. Electricians that worked on steam engines, they're all out of work. And that went on in Ashland, it went on in Antigo, it went on in Spencer, it went on in Owen. Job after job. And the steel mills, my daughter was there when that happened. She said, she called me one night, she says, I just had the most depressing experience. I said, what's that? She says, I talked to a man who's 55, just got laid off, the steel mill is closed, and the only thing this guy can do is smell when steel is ready to be poured. Now, I laughed, and she says, don't laugh, Dad. This is probably the most important job in the steel mill. If his nose goes twitch, your steel is shot. And I thought, you're kidding. So when I went over there, I talked to somebody. And he said, no, he said, that's true. There's a guy in every crew who's got the nose. And he smells the heat. And when it's ready to go, it goes.
So
now, the thing about the owl that kind of disturbs me is thing that all this lumber is going overseas anyway. I just did not see it go.
Really, what the heck are we doing that for?
Well, you could make more money shipping the log. If you own the log, you can get more money for it shipping it than you can processing it here.
If money continues to be the reason we do everything, we're screwed.
It is.
we're all down the tube.
What difference does it make if we ship it overseas or we ship it to New York City?
American jobs.
Yeah. You just ship it. You never see it again. It's gone.
But the money stays in our country.
It's quality of the United States that we're all fighting for.
Dara, did you have something?
I was just going to add to that. Did anybody see on the public TV, there's a show on ethics, and it comes from Harvard. There's a Harvard Law School. It was on this exact issue, and it was a systematic approach on arguing over the old growth. And by their definition, I forget who it was in the country, but it was like 600 to 1,000 year old trees. So that's how they established the definition of what old growth was. But what you were bringing up, the only reason that sparked, there was a historian there, and he said that throughout all of mankind history, any job-related industry that's been associated with a resource has always been up and down and goes through extinction. Yeah. So, in a sense, the logger little family that nestled around oak growth is going to become a dinosaur. And it's just a fact of life that evolution and change through time happens.
Our ghost town.
Perfect case in point is Chicago From Chicago to Valparaiso to Milwaukee with the white pine over in Michigan. Chicago was built on Michigan white pine. My grandfather used to unload the boats. They'd come in every day, two or three of them unload. All the white pine is cut down. Having breakfast about 4 years ago in New Buffalo, Michigan, the guy is talking to me. He says, I'm from St. Louis. I said, what the devil are you doing up here? Well, he says, I'm buying up timber tracks. I says, timber tracks for what? White pine. I looked at him, I said, it's all gone. He says, no. It's coming back. Hear what I'm going to say now. Better now than it was when they clubbed it in the 90s and the 10s and the zeros in the turn of the century. And he says, well, you're buying up now? He says, oh, yes. He says, I got a whole stack full of contracts in my back pocket. I said, but people live there. He said, I don't care where they're living. The white pine is in their backyard. And we're buying up everything we can. And then he really dropped a bomb on me. He said, do you know how old the seats are? I said, oh, a couple of years. George Washington was in Washington, D.C. These seats were being dropped in the ground.
Whoa, what are they doing growing just now?
Hey, go up here. If you can dig some seeds out and get them to a carbon testing place, I'll bet you anything some of the seeds up here are 200-300 years.
You mean they hang around till they're ready to grow?
Yeah, a lot of them stand in the soil.
I hate to say it, ready to pop. That's the best thing I've ever heard of.
Huh. I think
white pine is one of the fire species that requires fire to...
It's like white birch.
Yeah. I was told recently that
we lived in our
floor, white oak is becoming, you know, they're extremely difficult to get. They're putting the red in and calling it white and mixing it up. Where you buy it, like I just had some floor put down, and it was supposed to be white oak, and it didn't look quite like it. And I found out it's a mixture. And that's what they're doing. They're putting in the red with the white because they can't get enough white.
Well, maybe this all points out that we, in our laws for unemployment compensation and relief and all that sort of thing, are compensating for the fact that some industries burn out from time to time and they have to be shifted and you have to get a new job or something.
One of the things I'm finding interesting in listening to the discussion, though, is that as soon as we talk about the human problems, we shift into almost anthropocentrism. Mm-hmm. You know, we start to isolate ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the obvious factors of that is that we talk about short-term vision in all of these issues. You know, and so we get caught literally with our pants down overnight because suddenly we realize that the old forests are gone. I mean, my goodness, who didn't have their eyes open for that? I was raised, my great grandfather homesteaded in Iowa, and from the moment I was born, my father said to me, he farmed, he was the third generation, none of my children will farm, it's dead. Mm-hmm. I'm the last generation, mm-hmm. And none of us have, and he was right. There was no place left for us, and so we were retooled as children to do something else, and all 37 grandchildren on both sides of the family are doing something else.
And that's true.
Because of that.
But they're earning a living.
Well, of course, but yeah. What I'm saying is that's a little longer vision,
yeah.
In terms of, and in some ways, if we have more of a holistic sort of understanding of ourselves, living in one factor is seeing beyond one generation.
Another thing that's going through my head is that we're being told that people are going to have four and five and six careers in a lifetime.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I'm also thinking, is that healthy? Yeah. Is that good, or is that just a fact that happened because our society is so bad?
Necessity.
We were told that 25 years ago.
Oh, you were?
Yes.
Well, ultimately, 20 years.
We're all
human-centered because who makes decisions?
My kids.
Mm-hmm. People make decisions, the trees don't.
Mm-hmm.
But
that doesn't mean we're human-centered. I think there are people who make decisions that are truly holistic.
Yeah, no, that's an intelligent. Mm-hmm. That's a sign of intelligence once you start creating that kind of an objective. But ultimately, it takes the human sensitive enough to intelligent enough to create that kind of an objective to have a land ethic.
Well, what's
a species
is extinct No human can make it a new one.
Well, I know, I feel real bad.
I don't think the chemists know yet how to do it.
I don't want to talk about Australia, but we used to have birds all around where I lived up near a mountain, and I'll tell you, we had the most gorgeous little, like a cardinal, but beautiful red, we call it a fiery tail. And each time I go back and I go up to where I used to live, there's no fiery tails left, not a one to be seen. I said to my brothers, what's happened around here? Well, I brought in a toad from Mexico, or, no, I understand it was Hawaii now. They told me Mexico was Hawaii, to get the toads in the sugar cane. And those toads have gone from the north of Queensland all the way down almost to Sydney, you know, 2,000 miles. They poison the birds' water, is what they're doing, and the government doesn't seem to be doing a thing about it.
Do they bring the toads in to eat the insects in
the
sugar?
They brought the toads in.
To protect the sugar.
Well, we were told Mexico, but I just read up on it, and it was Hawaii. They brought them in to get rats or something in the sugar cane, northern Queensland. And those toads have migrated, you know, 1,500 miles south, and I know this particular bird is extinct now, because I don't know how many others,
the habitat
that one I know that's loose.
Human ingenuity has done that all over the country.
The world.
It seemed, you know, one of the things, I guess I've lived long enough to see some long-term things happen now.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the things that has impressed me to no end was up in Wisconsin when they quit going out there and planting trees. One of the Weisenheimers down in Neenah got the idea that maybe the rabbits and the deer and the eagles and the owls and the beaver and the rest of them could do a good job of reforestation. Okay? So they started doing that. And you know what? It works a darn sight better than us sticking a plant every 6 inches and then praying it's going to grow. And when it started, everybody said they were crazy and nuts and all the rest of it. But then they took everything off. They went down to 6 inches. Everything got chopped. And it was surprising that they were back, because I lived there to watch this. In 9 years, they were back harvesting pulpwood. And one of the guys who had been there for a long time said, you know, we're getting better pulpwood than we got before when we were sending these crews in to plant 89 million trees. We're getting better pulpwood, a better grade. And they couldn't figure that one out for a while. And finally they said, nature has a way of putting a tree where it's supposed to grow. We just put them in the ground because we think it should be 6 inches apart.
Now, I would have to say that whenever you're talking about they're harvesting pulpwood again, although 9 years later they're harvesting wood, the ecosystem, I don't think, can rebound in 9 years.
The ecosystem has got so much rotten wood in Wisconsin, you could pile it from here to there and back again.
Well,
you can't cut.
Well,
never even get to.
Okay, but I guess what I want to say is that I'm going to step out of the role I usually take, because I work with secular groups of teachers. I think that in order to be responsible stewards of the creation that we have here, we have got to work toward a holistic land ethic. We can't base all our decisions on economics. It will not work. And that means that we are all going to have to pay out of our pockets if we want this to happen. The young woman over here the other day said that, made the wonderful point that we have to, as environmentally conscious people, we have to be prepared to help bear the burden for the people who are going to lose out in ecologically sound decisions. You know, we don't have to go to the lumber yard or to the old growth forest to look at decline of industry. We've got a village right here that crashed overnight.
That's right.
Overnight. They said the price is low, we've lost too much. The boat's leaving tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And linens were left on the lines, and dishes and food were left on the tables, and everybody just left. That was a crash. Everyone had to go elsewhere to find work. Okay, this happens. If we can, as Christians, and Lord knows we've got a lot to think about in this world. But if we can anticipate that this is going to happen, press for it, but anticipate it, then perhaps we can find some ways to help mitigate the loss for the people who are going to suffer it. I think as long as we are human-centered, and Al Pitcher said something interesting. He believes, he said flat out the other day, basically, you can't understand the gospel unless you're holistic-minded. And then went on to say something like, we are destroying our whole biological, chemical, geological, even, basis for human existence. Well, to me, that popped in an anthropocentric thing. Human existence, to me, is not the bottom line. We want to live, of course, but we can't necessarily make all of our decisions
for ourselves.
For ourselves. Or even for our children. Any responses?
So what are you saying? That there truly is an ethic system that is superior to other ethic systems? In direct contradiction to your opening statement?
Yeah, I think that I have come to the point where I do. I do.
And how far, how much do you believe that? Do we go to the point of war with non-ecologically sound countries? Suppose the United States adopts a holistic system today, mm-hmm. and Europe continues on its merry way, which is not holistic. Mm-hmm. What do we do?
Or even go down into Brazil to protect the rainforest.
Are we on a crusade? Are we on a crusade
with military force?
Yeah, are we enough? Are we holistic enough to invade Brazil to stop?
I don't.
Good question.
I don't have an answer to that.
I think if this country could turn around that much, by that time the whole world will have turned around.
That's awesome.
We are so far behind everyone else. Well, it's true. I mean, really, our lifestyle is really despicable.
In some ways, you're ahead of I feel ahead of Australia anyway, the way they're killing the kangaroos and all that. I feel like crying when I get back.
I saw a t-shirt here in the building a day or so ago, we may still be here. It said, we did inherit the earth from our ancestors, we're borrowing from our children. And maybe the population of this world is going to have to shrink in order to make the whole thing work.
I often think that.
We don't have to keep expanding population necessarily. Mm-hmm.
Many people would tell you that the root of all of our problems is population.
Yeah.
Well, Al was talking about that for this morning. Mm-hmm. He's got some gory statistics. You want to get shook up. Yeah. What he's saying, we're doubling every 38 years, folks.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man, this is crazy.
Well, when you look at the curves of food supply to population, they're going to cross in the next, 20 years?
Yeah.
And something gives.
I'd welcome disagreement with me. You know, if you were in Stuart's session this morning, if you disagree with me, you have something to give me.
This raises another question. The question of abortion, which we're fighting right now in this country, mm-hmm. whether we can or can't. And maybe abortion sometime in the future is going to be required to keep the population down.
Surely not a holistic approach. Population control is certainly not a holistic approach.
It's very similar if you don't match these things.
Do you want to explain that?
Well, what are we talking about today? Pritchard was talking about that. What are you going to do? How many geniuses are you killing through abortion? By controlling the population.
Yeah, he brought that.
I think a man has stepped, or a woman, or we've stepped out of our role a long time ago. We've taken God's role in our, we just do our own thing, whatever that happens to be.
We've taken a master's role. I guess I wouldn't say that we've taken God's role, or we wouldn't have the messes that we have here.
Another problem I have,
badly put, but
is
I understand what you're saying.
In the history of American Protestantism, or Lutheranism, to be specific, a holistic approach has not been the what the church has preached. So are you going to leave the church?
You're absolutely right. This hasn't been preached.
From day one, you have these Protestants land on here and say, I am here, and we are going to march across the country until we conquer all and manifest destiny. And then we might even go to the Philippines to get it too. So,
you're absolutely right.
And that's been led by the church movement as much as anybody.
You're absolutely right from the very beginning.
We're founded by people who persecuted church members.
And our whole history as a human race, really, has been anthropocentric.
Yeah. That, most churches are anthropocentric.
Yes.
But
you're doing it too
hard. Yeah. I've been trying for years to get the plastics or the styrofoam cups out of our church. I've done everything.
Yeah, like them anyway.
I've done everything, including offering after the coffee hour to wash all the dishes by hand. I mean, had a whole group of us fighting. We put something in the bulletin, and we said, please, you know, Weyerhaeuser, most of us got our support from Weyerhaeuser, a paper company. We were buying plastics. I wrote a big article in the thing. It never got, somehow never got published in the weekly bulletin. I mean, it got lost in the shuffle. They said, write another article. I was a genius when I wrote that first one. I could never write the second one. So anyway, so much for that. And I'll go to the church and I will, you know, have plastic cups out, and I go in the kitchen and I get my cup and I wash it. And we, our circle, we even got, like we got mugs, you know, we got mugs for everybody. If you got one person that has done the purchasing for your church, they've done it for the last 30 years, by God, they're going to do it again. And, you know, how do you change people like that? You just can't.
Well, it has to be, this is an important question we can end with. And again, you may disagree with me, and you just have felt constrained for some reason not to say anything. But if you feel that change is important, that the way we're going is not the way we should be going, how can you affect change? What are some ways that you can affect change?
Intelligent decision.
I think just the way you started too.
Okay, intelligent decision-making on your own part. I would add to that informed decision-making. Okay, you can be very bright, but if you don't know the history or the facts, then it's hard to make intelligent decisions.
I guess, I'm probably speaking a little deeper than that. Knowledge is just a value, okay? And each value that we've been talking about, whether it's political, economic, or whatever, all those, in decision theory, all those values have to be taken on and at least looked at. And as I spoke with you earlier, I tell these people about, there's a philosophy of the systems, systemic philosophy of making intelligent decision and planning. And I'm an architect, so I studied a little of this with an advisor who got his doctorate degree at Berkeley. But there's people that actually try to model the whole world and problems and look at the bigger element of life and making intelligent decisions. Well, the systemic philosopher would look at it, the systems approach of intelligent decision making would begin when you start looking through the eyes of another. And you'd study the whole element of values, which is axiology, and that's a whole series of study in itself. But there's some principles that I would add to, like there's what they would look at as a symmetry of ignorance. What you know, I might not know. What I know, you might know. So automatically we have to get together and look at all these values and get specialists together to talk about all this. If there's no such thing, they would disagree with the element of an expert, because each problem in planning
is unique to that time. Time is a value. And so they're more of a generalist. Looking at it from a generalist standpoint is more intelligent decision making. The only thing that I've seen close that's like this public TV show on ethics from time to time, from the school, law school of Harvard, it's excellent. I mean, they touch on different shows, so keep your eyes open for that one. But anyway, from a systemic approach for just intelligent planning there's a book by C. West Churchman on the systems approach, and because you have to look at long term, you have to set up short term objectives 1 or 2 years for looking at long term generations, and it's just
put that down.
When you put all those important qualities elements in the decision making process, it's ideal. It's Anyway, so that's a study in itself, but it'd be something that I'd like to people aware of.
Okay, so making good decisions.
Right.
Oh, and we didn't even
based
get to our other framework, but that's okay. Based on lots of knowledge. What else?
I think from the other end, doing exactly what you did, which is starting to bug the people right around you about something that you clearly can see as good or bad. Mm-hmm. I think we can all
start locally.
Mm-hmm. Right in your
start life. With yourself.
Yeah. Start with yourself.
Bring your own cup. Carol.
You know, what I was just thinking was, I was listening to your discussion of systems thinking, and that's a real, that's how things ought to be, but it takes a long time. And there's so many, most of us can take action at some sort of level at this point.